There was a lot of hope today that President Trump, after he had a meeting of his cabinet, was maybe going to announce that there is a deal with the Iranian side. He told us last Saturday we were moments away from a deal. We have largely got it 95% of the way there, he said. And then the hope was after, I don't know who actually would have hoped this, but some hoped that after this cabinet meeting today, because it was a broadcast ahead of time, that there would be some kind of an announcement. And what a shock. There was no announcement other than more chaos. And we're going to try to figure out where this leaves us now, because the Strait of Hormuz is still fully blockaded by Iran on one side and the United States Navy on the other side. Oil still is not getting through. President Trump is not worried about it, though, according to what he said. Try to help us break all this down. We have back with us today Larry Johnson, friend of the show, sonar21.com, son of the new American Revolution on Substack, former CIA analyst and snappy dresser. Larry, welcome back to the show as always.
Yes, sir. Glad to be back.
Well, listen, it seems like every time you come on, it's always a great deal because a lot of things are going on, and especially because Trump literally just spoke moments ago in front of the cameras. We would like some of your feedback on some of this. Let's take a look, first of all, where he's talking about the central issue here is about opening the Strait of Hormuz. Iran has been saying that it's non-negotiable. They will never give up control of the Strait of Hormuz, but they are willing to allow traffic to go back to normal with some fee provisions. President Trump was asked about that.
Would you accept a short-term deal that allows Iran and Oman to control the strait? And would they have to open it immediately, or would you be open to that happening over a period of time?
No, the strait's going to be open to everybody.
And who would control
it? It's international waters. Nobody's going to control it. We're going to watch over it. We'll watch over it, but nobody's going to control it. That's part of the negotiation that we have. They would like to control it. Nobody's going to control it. It's international waters, and Oman will behave just like everybody else, so we'll have to blow them up. They understand that. They'll be fine.
Or we'll have to blow them up. I mean, that is diplomacy at its finest. What do you think of that?
Yeah, he's lost touch with reality. It is not international waters. Territorial waters of a country extends 12 miles out from the shore. So that takes you right to the middle of the Strait of Hormuz. I think at that one point is actually 23 miles across. So you can make the claim that both Oman and Iran share a portion of the Strait of Hormuz. But it is Iran has made it very clear. They're not relinquishing control. They are going to charge fees, just as Turkey charges fees to ships. Let's call it environmental damage for passing through the Dardanelles. So Iran's going to do that. The real question is, are they going to allow any ships that are tied to Israel to pass through? And at this point, I'd say no. But some of it has been open for negotiation. But bottom line is they're going to be charging a fee, and there's not a thing the United States can do about it.
You know, there's lots of conflicting information here. I'm going to show you here in a little bit a portion of our show yesterday with Professor Mirandi from Tehran University. Right. And one of the interesting things he said, which we don't have a clip of here, which I found interesting, I asked him what were the non-negotiables for Iran, which he laid out. But he surprised me by saying, he goes, this is not a surprise to the administration. He goes, I've seen the text. This is yesterday. He said, I've seen the text of the proposed agreement. And he said, we're remarkably close. He said, I'm actually surprised at how close the two sides are. So whoever is, I guess the intermediary is either Pakistan or Oman or whoever it is right now. But the two sides of their talking, he said that they're remarkably close. So he thought it could be that way. Well, earlier this morning, this was reported by Al Jazeera that the IRGC Navy said that they now felt that war was unlikely. There was also on Iranian TV, they showed what they said was an interim 14-point agreement that had largely been agreed to by the two sides. And they put all these things on there, which were very similar to the Iranian 10-point plan, which supposedly started all this stuff. The White House, about an hour and a half ago and right before President Trump spoke, said, oh, no truth to that. Absolutely none. Definitely not on any of that stuff. What do you make of this apparent, Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde kind of thing, even on the U.S. side?
Yeah, it is schizophrenic. We get, to pick a side and you'll be right because both sides are being showing up as options. Look, the Trump doesn't have any good military options. And those options have been further constrained by the actions of Saudi Arabia and Qatar, who are signaling that they're not going to let their airspace be used anymore by the United States. That creates a real operational problem for the U.S. because then they have to channel air refueling ops into Iraq. Now, Iraq's not going to be happy about that either, but there's not a lot Iraq could necessarily do to stop it. But still, it does limit what the United States can actually do in terms of carrying out an air assault on Iran, because that's our only option. We can't do a naval. You know, ships aren't going to sell up and start launching Tomahawk missiles. I mean, they can do that, but it's a limited supply. We're not going to attack with a ground force, so we're left with air operations, and those air operations are completely dependent upon Saudi Arabia in order to be carried out, because my understanding is the combat aircraft are being kept in Israel and Jordan. And so it's still they've got an 800-mile flight to get to, say, Riyadh, and those planes only go 550 miles without needing to be refilled. So right away, just to even to try to reach the western shore of the Persian Gulf, if you're going to launch a standoff missile from there, you've got to be refueled at least once. And really, the reality is you're going to be refueled probably three times minimum. So that's why you need Saudi Arabia. And if Saudi say no, nope, then you've got a whole nother path to worry about. And once you're forced into one only sort of like one corridor, it makes it easy from an air defense standpoint or from Iran's standpoint to begin to try to counter that threat. So that's why I say Trump's caught. And then the economic dimensions of this, they were really, I just had lunch with an oil trader, a guy that's been involved with trading oil, for 25 years. And, he's done it in London and done it in San Francisco. And he says, it's not making sense. He says right now, if you try to look at the markets and say, okay, we're going to be logical and rational, supply and demand, that if supply goes up, demand goes down, it's going to have a particular effect on the price. He says, none of that holds anymore because there's actual manipulation going on behind the scenes. People will look at the price of oil, go to oilprice.com, and there they post up the Brent and the WTI, West Texas Intermediate. Well, those are future contracts. Now, what's the actual price of oil like in Singapore? Well, that's, $140 to $160. There's the problem. The market is not clearly identifying what the actual price is. They're covering it up. They are suppressing it. So you got to step back and say, why are they suppressing this? Yeah, see, that's not the actual cost of oil. That's a future contract.
Yeah, that's for July right here. And they typically have it 1 month in advance of what is the paper price here. I guess some in the Western countries I saw actually yesterday, it was $120. But still, that's a $40 jump. And by the way, this all jumped down overnight just because there was claims that President Trump was close to a deal. But, you can fool me once, shame on you, fool me twice, I'm an idiot. This happens all the time now. And especially now after it's been like 8 or 10 times, not just one or two. I don't understand why there's this huge drop here unless there's something going on with those who do the markets, because it almost doesn't make sense any other way.
Yeah, let's try. It's happened at least 13 times.
Okay, 13, I understand. Yeah,
we're 13 weeks into this. This has been happening every week. Every week. And you got the, hey, man, we're close. We got a deal at hand. And then, this problem cropped up. Al Jazeera last night was out with a report. Oh, yeah, they've agreed to it. And I wrote a piece that lays out all the different, points of disagreement. And these are not easily bridged. Iran's standpoint, which is they want the assets unfrozen. They want the sanctions lifted immediately, not some promise in the future. Now, reportedly, the United States was saying, well, we can't unfreeze all. We'll give you some money, but not all. And as far as sanctions, you know, that's got to be, you've got to meet certain benchmarks, and then we'll consider lifting them. Iran's been down that road already with JCPOA. They're not doing that again. Then there's the issue of the war in Lebanon and Gaza and the West Bank.
Yeah, pardon me. I'm going to get to that in just a second, but okay. Let me show you. There's a new wrinkle that was put in during President Trump's conversation today, which some people have been talking about it kind of on the side. He had talked about it in terms of some of the Arab regimes, but here President Trump adds in that it's almost a non-negotiable that Iran has to join the Abraham Accords.
If they don't sign to join the Abraham Accords, I don't know that we have countries in there already. UAE, great countries, bold countries. And it's turned out to be so good, so effective. And so we're, requesting strongly that they join. It'll be great. It'd be great for Saudi Arabia. It'd be great for Qatar and Kuwait, the whole group.
So the Iran deal might be contingent on more countries joining the
Accords. I don't want to say that. I'm not going to give you, what's contingent, what's not. I can say that we can make a good deal right now, but maybe not a great deal. And if it's not a great deal, we're not making it. Because we can make a great deal with this guy right here.
So he says, no, it's not contingent, but if they did, it would be a great deal. And if it's not a great deal, we're not going to join, but it's not contingent. What is he talking about? And why would Iran, why would Israel want Iran to join the Abraham Accords? And then we'll talk separately about Saudi Arabia. And they're pretty strong on where they stand on this. What do you make of this throwing that monkey wrench in today?
Well, Israel probably would welcome that if it was guaranteed that Iran was no longer was willing to acknowledge that they're a legitimate state. That is, Iran does not see the Zionist regime as a legitimate state. And so for that reason, it's not going to recognize it. But it's not just Iran. Trump said that in a Truth Social post yesterday. And Saudi Arabia wasted no time coming out saying, hell no. No, none of that. We're not doing anything with the Abraham Accord until the Palestinians have a state and they have international protection. So, that Trump is he's pushing something that is, it has no chance of success whatsoever.
Now, he also said, we don't have a clip for this one, but he also said during this press conference here that he's not under any time pressure. I'm not worried about the midterms. I don't care about the price of oil. Don't care about any of that kind of stuff. We're not going to do anything until we get a good deal. So let's just, first of all, take a look at that. Does President Trump actually have the luxury of just not worrying about this and we'll just let the blockades go on indefinitely?
No. I mean, the economic impact of this has yet to be fully felt in the United States, but it's already started. Inflation, I think we're going to find that the actual inflation rate in the United States could be up as high as 17-20% by the end of the year, with prices accelerating that quickly across the board. And it's not just that the cost of goods are going up. There's also going to be shortages, and the shortages will also further aggravate the price hikes. I talked to two different people today. Alex White, who runs, he's got a YouTube channel called Reporterfy Media. He is a derivatives trader, has lived in China for like 20 years. This other gentleman is an oil trader. And both were saying, the markets are not acting normally. What do we mean by that? It's like if you've got 10 apples and you've got one person that wants to buy an apple, well, you got more supply than there is demand. So you'll have to price your apples accordingly so that one person might want to buy it. If you got 20 people that want 10 apples, all of a sudden you're in a position where you can ask for a higher price for that scarce supply. So that's, you know, that's what we said, a normal market responds to supply and demand. Well, right now the world is experiencing something it has never experienced in the modern era, and let's go back in the last 300 years, where you had a sudden disruption of 20% of the world oil supply. You have a disruption of a 10% of the world's global supply of liquid natural gas. And when saying these are disrupted, it's not like there are alternatives, that there's some idle, you know, gas pump or they're sitting out there. All you have to do is turn it on and you immediately make up for that deficit. No, that doesn't exist. But then on top of that, the shortages, the production of urea, production of sulfur, production of helium. Helium is disrupted to the tune of about 44%. So when you take all of that off of the market and you're assuming that you've got consistent, that the demand has not dropped, well, the prices are going to go up, and in some cases dramatically. And in some cases, there will be shortages. Things will not get made. And nobody sat down, to my knowledge, and really thought all of this through, really examined all the linkages. Because, you know, like when you talk about sulfur, say, okay, so what? Well, I didn't realize you got to get the actual sulfur then to create sulfuric acid. And why is sulfuric acid important? Well, it was involved with everything from the manufacturing of fertilizer used in conjunction with urea to processing metals to other industrial processes. And like with helium, that affects on computer chips. So yeah, we're witnessing, and it's been underway now for 3 months, a massive global economic shock with a shortage and disruption of the supply chain. And yet everybody's acting like, hey, it's all cool, man. This is great. It doesn't make sense.
You know, we're actually going to have an energy expert, Art Berman, on the show here at 3 o'clock this afternoon. He's going to get into that. But I'm just curious, what do these oil traders and these other folks think from what you've talked to? How long can this fiction go on before the physical impact starts to overcome the claims?
The last gentleman I was with, the oil trader, he described it as this Ponzi scheme.
Yeah.
He thinks it can last through August.
That's a long time.
Yeah, they can continue to sort of stall it out and pretend that everything's cool. But, you know, like they get that $90 price of oil for July. I don't see how the United States and Iran come to an agreement, given what the Zionist pressure is on Donald Trump. And it is significant. It's not insignificant. And
Larry, let me just go there, because there are headwinds, not just because of the, I don't know, psychological problems the president has of just coming up with whatever his point is, but he's also got a lot of headwinds inside of his own orbit here. Let's take a look at a few of them here. First of all, on CBS News was H.R. McMaster, former national security advisor, who's saying he doesn't really see the outlines turning into anything.
If you just saw the, you know, the supreme leader who still hasn't, we still haven't heard his voice, we still haven't seen his image, but he put out a written statement yesterday saying, hey, well, the U.S. has to get out of the region completely. You're not going to be safe on your bases. It doesn't sound like there's any kind of progress toward an agreement, mainly, I think, because Iran is unwilling to give on any of the fundamental issues, like removing what the president calls the nuclear dust, you know, or pledging no enrichment, saying, hey, we're not going to pursue a nuclear program or nuclear weapon. And now Iran is adding into it as well that there would have to be a ceasefire in Lebanon for Israel to stop, you know, really what are defensive strikes against this drone complex that Hezbollah is trying to reseed in southern Lebanon.
Now, we're going to get to the Lebanon part here in just a second. But I mean, here's H.R. McMaster, and he's like saying, look, until Iran is willing to submit and capitulate on all their terms, he goes, I just don't see the outlines of a plan. If that's what we're looking for, in my view, there is no possibility. And yet, why is President Trump and his allies still thinking like there's going to be one?
Yeah. Well, and for McMaster to say that, pretend that this is like some new demand by Iran, that was the original demand in the 14-page, the 14 points they delivered, you know, in early April. They haven't changed, you know, we're 2 months now since they've submitted, saying here's our non-negotiable positions. I don't know what game the White House is playing, because it's not like we need to buy ourselves time so we can build up our supply of Tomahawk missiles so we can go back and be effective in the attack. Because we're already, apart from the rare earth minerals, there's also the issue of tungsten. Where tungsten is an essential metal used in the production of both aircraft and weapons. So, I guess Trump and company are hoping that they get some sort of miracle solution. But Iran's not backing down. And what the other part of this is playing out is you've got a lot of activity from Pakistan. Pakistan's General Munir is working behind the scenes, working closely and coordinating and talking to the Saudis, Qataris, as well as the Turks, the Egyptians, and Iran. And I was told earlier this week that the Pakistanis have offered a nuclear umbrella to Saudi Arabia, basically said, hey, we'll sign an agreement with you, and that if you're ever attacked, or you'll be able to present that you have a nuclear capability because of your relationship with us, that the Pakistanis were willing to extend that. And he said, well, gee, why would Saudi Arabia need that? Oh, I don't know, Israel, you know, if they're concerned about the possibility of a nuclear attack from Israel, because they're clearly not worried about a nuclear attack from Iran. But so you got those activities going on behind the scenes, and with China and Russia both adamant about erecting a new security architecture there in the Persian Gulf. And it was fascinating. McMaster said, oh, they want to force the United States out. The United States is already, from a de facto standpoint, forced out of most of the bases that it once occupied.
Yeah.
Simply because they were destroyed or severely damaged. Al Udeid in Qatar appears to be the one exception to that. And so, you know, this is, they keep stringing this process out, and it's being used to make money. Can I prove that someone in the Trump orbit is making money off of this? No, I can't. But it certainly needs to be looked at.
Well, it does, and because obviously there's so many of these trades, these magical mystery trades that come oftentimes literal minutes before a big swing happens, makes it very self-evident that there is some insider knowledge, et cetera. But if that's all it is, it's just to help make some individuals who are already super wealthy become even more super wealthy, somehow that doesn't seem like that could be enough, because it's not
sustainable. Right.
But here's the thing, and let me show you one other here. Here's Senator Rick Scott, obviously a very loyal Republican in the Senate. He's even more pessimistic than HR is.
There's no deal if they continue to have nuclear capabilities at all. They shouldn't have ballistic missile capabilities. And so do I believe it's going to be easy to get a deal? I think it's going to be hard. I mean, these are ideologues. So I'm optimistic. You know, the president has gotten a lot of stuff done, but we're dealing with some crazy people that have crazy ideas. And so who knows what else we have in store. But I do know this. I don't see there's any way Trump will give in unless they have no ability to have a nuclear weapon or ballistic missiles. I think either that we're going to have unbelievable hostilities, or we're going to have a deal. It's going to be one of those two things. I don't believe there'll be a ceasefire while they have the ability, and then negotiate in 60 days. I just don't believe that's going to happen.
So he's basically saying, look, anything that Iran wants, forget about it. That's not going to happen. He, kind of like McMaster, is saying they're going to have to submit. But here's the thing. If we're on that position and Iran's still over here, and that's where it's been for a while, then what's the play for the administration? Because you're not going to solve it here. And as you just said, there is no military path to solve it by force. Therefore, what is the play, man?
Yeah, they're making it up. I mean, there is no strategy here. That's the problem. It's very much focused on trying to get as good a deal as possible, and then to paint it as the most amazing outcome that has ever been achieved.
Okay, but see, here's the problem with that. They had it. It was apparently earlier today, and I think as Robert Barnes has told us both here, that's not the first time that there has been one. So if that was the objective, we could already have had that, and then Trump can paint it however he wants to. But every time they get close, and apparently again today, now all of a sudden they walked it back, and we're back where we were before.
Yeah. Well, that's because Trump is a split personality. There is a part of him that actually wants to get a deal done, and that is not tied to any ideological position. But then the other half of him is completely beholden and chained to the Zionist lobby, and he cannot escape that. And I don't know if they've got blackmail material on him or what, but whatever they agree to that doesn't serve the interests of Israel, and that, you know, that comes back to one of the key stumbling blocks in this is Iran's insistence, not suggestion, but their insistence, their demand that the war in Lebanon and the war against the Palestinians cease. And Trump is in a position that he could stop Bibi, but he doesn't. And we've seen that the so-called, you know, initially this the original ceasefire was put on hold until Trump called Bibi and said, okay, you got to stop the bombings. And they stopped for a bit. But just gradually, piece by piece, Israel's gone back to bombing Lebanon.
Yeah, now, I don't know if you can read the small print on here, but this is 43 minutes before we came on the air. Israeli air, drone, and artillery strikes killed at least 10 people across southern Lebanon, hitting several districts, et cetera, and also around Ben Jabil. So that's just an hour ago. It continues on. So there's evidence that Trump is either not able or doesn't care, and Netanyahu definitely does care.
Right. Yeah, and that now,
Danny, we have some breaking news here. You know how he's building the big, most beautiful ballroom in the world? Well, it's just been announced that he's planning to rebuild the Pentagon into the Star of David. Now, this is just rumor.
You sure? But, so that's got to be Babylon. That's got to be Babylon B.
It is. It is. It is.
Oh my God. Yeah, it is. What Trump's got going on here is that even if he wants to have the deal with Iran, the deal killer from Iran's standpoint is what's going on in Lebanon and Gaza and the West Bank. So, and that goes back to the Abraham Accords, where the Saudis as well said, you're not doing that until the Palestinian question is settled. So Israel ultimately has the veto power over any agreement the United States wants to engage in with Iran. And I don't see, it's not just Bibi. Get rid of Bibi. You still got, you know, the vast majority of the Zionists who insist that, you know, there's not going to, you got to destroy Iran. It's got to go. You can't coexist with it.
Yeah. There's several people. Naftali Bennett apparently is a leading candidate to be the next prime minister. And we definitely know where he falls on that. He has been begging Biden all those years to try and do the same. I want to go. There's a number of different headwinds against this. There was some inside the Trump circle. And then there's the obvious one in Iran. I mentioned Professor Mirandi yesterday, and I just pinpointed down, and I say, are these 4 points here non-negotiable for Iran? Here's what he had to say. From the Iranian perspective, for this war to come to an end and for the dueling blockades to leave and to have any chance of a resumption of the flow of oil to even approximate what it was before this war started, Iran's going to have unfrozen assets that's their money freed up.
The sanctions have to be waived for the energy sector, not all sanctions, just the energy sector.
Okay, so the sanctions on the energy sector, an end of war negotiated terms of some sort, some kind of an agreement on that, and a stoppage of the war against Hezbollah in southern Lebanon. So if all four of those things happen, then the Iranian side will agree to. But let me not mischaracterize, if any of those four things don't happen, then there won't be an end. Is that a fair statement?
Yes, that's right. And of course, the siege on the Strait of Hormuz, I'm not sure if you said that or not. But yes, you're absolutely correct.
So there was four. He actually said there's five. Yeah, and we retain control of the Strait of Hormuz. So again, he separately told me that those were understood by the American side, and whoever they're dealing with through the mediators were apparently something close to that, so that they thought they had a deal this morning. And yet all those things I just showed you, I could trot out Mike Pompeo, who's been really active here lately, Senator Graham, Rebecca Heinrichs, just you name it, all these people, all Jack Keane, of course, is the biggest one, all screaming the exact opposite, that something very different is even in the mix. And how can President Trump ever listen to all these people and let them go out there and then come back with anything that even looks like the one that Professor Mirandi told? How can you square that circle?
Well, and this goes back to something that Robert Barnes, who did serve as Trump's attorney several years ago during his first term, that the old Donald Trump used to be like, if you had this issue, he'd be calling up 20 different people with different points of view saying, hey, what do you think? What about this? He would be out gathering additional information. What Barnes says is now Trump doesn't do that. He stopped doing that. So he basically gets locked into those people that he's talking to. And who's he talking to? He's talking to Lindsey Graham regularly, to Sean Hannity regularly, to Laura Loomer, that nut job. He's not going out seeking any alternative views, any competing views. And so that's another element that I think is constraining this. So this optimism that's being put out, oh, yeah, we've got an agreement, it's near at hand. I'm in touch with someone who's connected with the Pakistani officials that are involved with this. And even they recognize they've got, there's still some major obstacles that are not resolved. They keep trying to, keep moving it along. Let's take a half step forward and as opposed to backwards. But I think the issues are just too significant, too fundamental. Now, also on the whole sanctions, the unfrozen assets issue, Trump may actually have his hands tied in that arena, depending upon, I can't give you the percentage, but a certain percentage of those frozen assets were frozen by actions of the U.S. Congress, not by actions of Donald Trump or through a previous president. So congressional action, the only way a president can get around that is by getting Congress to act again to withdraw the legislation that led to confiscation.
Well, you just mentioned Robert Barnes. He just texted me literally just this minute and said Trump blew it up again, rug pull number five. So that apparently explains why the Iranians thought that they were close to a deal, why they were apparently saying this morning that they thought there wouldn't be a return to war. And then now apparently Trump has pulled the rug again. So I just don't know where we can go from here, because one has to start to wonder who's actually calling the shots inside the White House, even forget about with him and Netanyahu. And because I'll tell you, somebody who's been pretty consistent and whose views have been pretty close to what American actions have been, and that's Jack Keane.
What's going on in Lebanon is instructive, too, in terms of where the Iranians' head is. I mean, they're under a ceasefire in Lebanon, and the Iranians have fired, Sean, 900 rockets and missiles into northern Israel, and have flown 1,200 drone attacks in there as well. And the inhabitants of northern Israel have had to flee their homes and villages, as a result of it. And certainly the Israelis are supposedly in a ceasefire themselves, and as a result of it, they can only react defensively. They open the straits, we remove the blockade. But here's what the Iranians will want. They want authority over it, even though it's open. Certainly, we're not going to tolerate any fees. But they still want to be in charge of the process. We cannot let that stand. We can't have any words that implies that Iran has territorial rights over the straits when international law recognizes it as international waters and freedom of navigation has got to be there.
So you heard Professor Mirandi, and that's echoed by all the senior Iranian officials, all of them. And those two key things, they will control the strait, and the Lebanon issue has to be included in there. And then you just heard Jack Keane there saying they will not control the strait, and they don't get to call any shots on Lebanon, which weirdly he said, no, it's Iran that's actually striking Israel from Lebanon. I don't know what he's thinking about there. I guess he just wants to pretend like they're one and the same, Hezbollah. But that leaves us, Larry, here's the real problem. Then there are only two options that I see here. Either we just keep on with the status quo and leave the dueling blockades indefinitely until I don't know what, or we return to war. But apparently we're not going to do a negotiated settlement and we're not going to do the walkaway. Where does that leave us?
In limbo, or let's call it the current status quo. So despite U.S. claims of a blockade, it's not an effective blockade, and ships are still allowed to both enter and leave the Strait of Hormuz, and operating in accordance with the new Persian Gulf Strait Alliance, the PGSA authority that Iran has established and is coordinating with Oman. And so the payment system is actually flowing through Chinese banks, not through banks tied to the West. So this is, that's why I continue to return to, you've got to look at what Iran has said are its essential demands, and that it's not backing away from those, and then to see, is the United States prepared to accommodate any of those? And I don't see how they do, unless Trump has a complete brain transplant, and that Bibi Netanyahu and billionaire heiress Miriam Adelson and the other billionaire Paul Singer, again, both ardent Zionists, that they no longer can call him or contact him or get him on the phone. But that's not the case. These people have direct, they have his phone number, and he answers his own phone. So they're still able to call him up. And then Netanyahu is all ready to hop a plane to come over to, buck up Trump, face to face. So this is, I'm with you. There is not a viable diplomatic solution here on the table that the United States would accept.
And what is your understanding of what's going on down at the tip of the spear? We kind of haven't looked at that for a while because we've been talking about the diplomatic stuff. There was some claims by Hegseth and several others maybe 2 or 3 weeks ago that we are locked and loaded and everything's ready to go and we can just on a dime launch back into some kind of kinetic operations. What is your understanding of what's happening down there?
So far, there are some warning indicators, and without I'm not going to give away the clues on that, but none of those warning indicators that you would see if we're getting ready for major combat operations are ramping up. So we're right now, you've got just what I call conventional air patrol. Surface combat air patrol, and they're running both east and west air patrols along the Persian Gulf. And this is almost more to dare Iran to attack them. Now, the Iranians have vowed they're going to, I don't know if they've really fully retaliated for the attack on the two naval vessels the other day, but so far they've actually been trying to keep this from escalating. They'll look the other way and those blown up a couple of high-speed boats all outside of Bandar Abbas. But you're not seeing yet the kind of activity, both message traffic-wise, movement of assets, air assets in particular, that you would associate with imminent combat. So, and again, I thought they might wait till the end of this week, but, Trump is, he's clearly getting pressure from the Zionist crowd, but he's also getting pressure from the Gulf Arabs and from Pakistan. And, let's not forget the Gulf Arabs, they have a lot of, carry a lot of U.S. debt. you know, they've been buying a lot of the treasury bills. So there's a way in which they do also have some leverage.
I guess we'll see. The real problem with it is one of the things that's just maddening to me, and I think if I'm hearing correctly from you as well, is that we're normally like we're using logic and common sense and evidence to say, all right, what can we divine based on the, you know, where this is going, et cetera, as though there was some logical cognition thought behind it, but it doesn't appear that there is. So I don't know how anybody can say, here's what's coming, here's what's not coming, here's where we're going. I don't know that anybody can say that with President Trump right now in his condition.
No, I mean, he's one minute he makes one decision, next minute he contradicts himself, makes the exact opposite. And, you know, I don't think Robert Barnes is making it up when he, you know, when he talks about the what people are seeing as noticeable differences in how Donald Trump talks, how he interacts with people, and how his ability to do any kind of basic analysis. So, you know, he just comes out, oh, we're going to bomb them. We're going to blow them up. All right. You know, how are you going to do that? Because you don't have enough aircraft and bombs to blow them up.
Yeah, that's just what is just unfathomable. I mean, this is unprecedented in American history. All 250 years, we've never been in a position like this where you can hate somebody. You can say, I don't like his policies and he's going down our path. But I don't think we've ever had a case, not even with Joe Biden, quite frankly, to where we said, I don't think that he's cognitively capable of performing the duties of the president of the White House.
Right. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean it's shocking that he's, and again I trust Robert Barnes on this because, you know, he didn't come out with an anti-Trump agenda. He was very very pro-Trump. I mean, he had served as his attorney, but there clearly people around Trump are seeing these odd behaviors, and you know, in particular with these negotiations, why do the negotiations even in public? Do them in private and then, you know, come out and announce, okay, we've now reached this agreement. Right. Instead, you're going back and you're literally at doing daily 180 degree turns. And, you know, if you do a full two 180s, you've done a 360, which means you're back where you started from.
Yeah. And the strait remains closed where it has been since we started this pointless war of choice. And that's the bottom line. And so these things are compounding, and there's going to come a day, whether it's August or something before that, you can't hide it at some point because the weight of the reality will impose itself. We'll have to wait and see what's going to happen. In the amount of time I got left with you, I'd like to get your view. I don't want to let you go without exploiting you a little bit further. And that's in the Russia-Ukraine war. Here just not long ago, Russia has warned of some significant strikes coming on decision-making centers in Ukraine. This is at least on the surface of it. It's because of a strike that happened on a Luhansk university with a dormitory that was hit, et cetera. But this is stuff that's been, we did this earlier today with Alexander Mercurius, where this is stuff that's been building up for literally many, many months. And now Russia apparently says, you know, you guys have been hitting this from crossing over into NATO airspace up in the Baltics. You've been given targeting information, obviously the specific weapon systems themselves. You have crossed a red line, and now it's time for us to show you we're sick of it, et cetera. What do you think is coming in Kiev?
Well, we got the first 10 of it from Danny Davis Deep Dive 2 weeks ago when you had Ambassador Dmitry Polyansky on your show. And, you know, then that was, you know, you know Dmitry as I do. I've met him in person. And great diplomat, but he's not a freelancer. He's not, and he doesn't. He doesn't carry the kind of political clout within Russian politics where he could go out and say sort of whatever he wanted to say. He's very much, you know, following what the institutional, what the party line is. So when he came out and was as direct and forthright about the Russian genuine concern that these attacks on civilian, and this was before the attack on the dorm, that that Europe was basically turning itself into a target, and that, you know, when I hear Dmitry Polyansky talk about Europe better watch out, you know that, my God, this is serious. And that was followed up a couple of days later with the Deputy Foreign Minister, Sergei Rybkov, who I've also met and spoke with back in December of 2023. And so when those two gentlemen are out saying the same thing, you know that this is not people's opinion. This is a new shift in policy. Then in the aftermath of that attack on the dormitory, Staroblesk, I think it is, and the murdering of these college students, Lavrov's warning and calling up Marco Rubio saying, you need to get your people out. Now, some said, well, gee, why, you know, why now? Why is Russia reacting like this now? They you know, they had that terrorist attack at the Crocus Theaters, yeah, you know, 3 years ago. And I think there are two reasons. Reason number one is that the extensive presence of Russian intelligence assets in these various Ukrainian units and locations, that Russia was not ready to, because if they hit those sites, then that intelligence goes away, and they'd have to forewarn their assets, you know, don't go to work today, call in sick, whatever. So that's one element. The other element is Russia was neither ready nor prepared. They reasoned that if we attack and kill a bunch of Western diplomats or intelligence personnel or military personnel, that we run a risk of the war expanding with NATO coming in then to join in on the attacks. And I think Russia calculated, we're not ready to face that. That was then. They are now. And that's why this message that came.
And what's changed? What militarily is Russia ready for now that they weren't before?
One, they've mobilized, you know, I think their mobilization of troops is up around 2 million. But more importantly, the number of Iskander, Kinshaw, the whole panoply of weapons, they now have they've got a good supply. The Oreshnik as well has been, you know, they've been steadily producing those at a rate of about two or three a month now for the last 16 months. So they've built up a supply that I think they finally calculated, okay, if we have to fight NATO, we can fight NATO. Wow. So I think that was probably the major reason why they didn't react like they're reacting now. Now they're prepared to take it home completely. And I don't think the Ukrainians are prepared to face what they're going to be confronted with. And the Europeans say, oh, yeah, we're going to stick it out. We'll see.
And what do you think is coming? Because, I mean, there was a lot of missiles that were used in Kiev 3 or 4 days ago. There's been obviously lots of multiple drone attacks that have happened over the time. They've hit several concerns, et cetera. Will it be just another one of those, or do you think it'll be something more significant?
No, I think it'll be more significant. Not only taking out, making sure that any place that's left that provides a gathering place or record storage for intelligence activities, military activities, those are going to be taken out. Those will be destroyed. I wouldn't be surprised if to see some action taken on the bridges over the Dnieper River to start cutting off Ukrainian units from resupply. So, or at least create greater challenges for that. So I think Russia's prepared to move on a broad front. And I think ultimately one of the reasons to warn the Westerners out of Kyiv is that Russia's going to come back and take it.
Do you still think it's possible they could physically move on Kyiv?
Yes. Yeah.
Now, yeah, that would just cause people in Europe, and I know we only have a few minutes left here, that caused a lot of heads to just explode.
Oh, yeah.
At what point do you think this batch of European leaders across the board, Starmer, Macron, Merz, et cetera, are going to say, oh, snap, we better do something different? Or do you think they'll say, you know what, this is what we've been telling you all along, those darn aggressive Russians, now that they're proven that we were right all along, and here they come, they're going to take over all this stuff, and can they do anything about it?
Yeah, the problem they have, problem Europe has, is the disconnect between the leadership and the people. The people are not politically in sync with this. Quite the contrast with what you're seeing with Russia. If anything, up until this point, you could argue that Putin was lagging behind Russian public opinion. Russian public opinion wanted more action against Ukraine, tougher action against Ukraine. And Putin in the past was trying to, you know, keep the war contained. Now Putin has come over and said, okay, that's it. You know, the gloves are coming off. And so it's not that, it's just the exact opposite of what you're seeing in Europe. In Europe,
I'm sorry, Gary, can you bring that headline back up there? This deserves a commentary here. Brother Zelensky is saying that Russia's mobilization proves that Moscow is not preparing for real diplomacy, even though they've been trying to do real diplomacy since April 2022,
right.
2024, and just ad infinitum. And it appears to me that he may be ironically right now that no longer is Russia worried about the diplomacy. They're going to take it to another level. Is that how you see it?
Well yeah. And in fact, that was Lavrov's message to Rubio, basically, hey, the Anchorage thing, forget about it. Whatever we talked about and agreed back then, it's no longer relevant. And he was just, you know, so the Anchorage process from last summer is dead. And this Russia will settle this militarily. You've got to you listen to the likes of Medvedev and Karaganov. Putin is now caught up. You know, he's now expressing and voicing what many, many Russians have been saying heretofore. So, again, this is the exact opposite. In the West, the leadership is way in front of the public. The public is not supportive of the policy. The leadership wants confrontation. Public doesn't. In Russia, it's Putin who is trying to reduce the confrontation with the West, but the public is now demanding it. And Putin said, yes, that it is. We're going to make Kyiv and all of the foreigners who are there pay a heavy price. Therefore, foreigners, get out while you can, because it may be too late in the next few days.
Well, I guess we'll have to wait and watch on that too. It's just anguishing to watch to see that it's come to this. I keep thinking back, not just to Istanbul in 2022, but to Putin's June 2024 options. And I think you and I both said at the time that we may look back and just beg for terms that were that good again. And now here we are, and it looks like those terms are no longer on the table. But
yep,
we are where we are.
Yep.
Well, listen, thanks very much for coming on. As always, we really appreciate you clarifying things for us on all these big issues, and really appreciate it.
Thank you, sir. We'll talk to you later.
We will be back in about 4 minutes from now with Art Berman, oil industry expert, and he is going to give it to you straight. He's one of the reasons we have this show, and one of the reasons we're asking him on today is because he will tell it to you like it is. He is unintimidated and uncompromised, and has been for his career, about telling the truth, and he's going to tell you what really is going on, despite what the market seemed to be telling you is happening with the oil industry, what we can expect in our tanks and in our fields and in our transportation systems coming up the rest of this summer into the fall. Tune in then. We'll see you in just a few minutes on the Daniel Davis Deep Dive. You know, we don't have sponsors because we hate to hit you over the head with ads. I don't like them. So show a little love back. Subscribe, like, and send this to somebody you care about.